Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Bristol singer-songwriter Rita Lynch and her son, Jimmy. Also, nuclear physics. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. We start this week with Rita Lynch again on Dialect here. Hi, Rita. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you just give us a bit of an update on what's happened with the Bush Residential Care Centre and remind us what it is?
The Bush Residential Unit is a respite unit for disabled children so that their parents can have a break of a night or a couple of nights a week or so.
Okay, how big is it and where is it?
It's in Hengrove and it has 10 beds. And in May, the council had this idea they wanted to close 5 of the beds to save money and put the children into a different sort of care situation.
Now, what would that have meant for parents like yourself?
Well, it would have meant that, because what they were saying was that we could put our children to foster care instead of the residential unit. And it would have meant that we would have, it would have made it very, very difficult because we all trust the Bush. And a lot of our children have been going there for quite a while. The staff are really fantastic, really experienced, really trained. And it would have been very difficult for our children because most of the children who attend the Bush are quite severely autistic. It would have been very difficult for them.
Now, look, we don't want to tempt fate, but it looks like you've had a bit of a victory, at least temporarily. Tell us how you think that's been achieved.
Well, it is quite amazing because I thought it was really all over because the mayor seemed intent on taking the 5 beds away. I think it was because a few people really helped campaign. Some of the parents did their bit as well. And some other people in Bristol who just were really concerned that a vital service was being taken away from disabled children, that they really kind of kept on campaigning. My son and myself were on the television twice and you know, we did our bit to try to let people know that this was happening.
Well, I'll tell you what, is the because we've got your son Jimmy in it with us today.
Yes.
It's actually really what you've done, I suppose, is show us that if you really believe that something should be saved and something shouldn't be cut, with a bit of hard work, it is possible to stop it.
I suppose that's kind of what's happened, yes, that if you keep on at it and if you try to get attention and exposure, especially for something that most people would agree should be kept, you know, because these are the most vulnerable sort of group of people in the country.
Now, before we have a chat with Jimmy, we'll have a go anyway. Tell us a bit about his disability.
My son Jimmy is 13 years old. He is quite severely autistic and he has a learning disability. He's also epileptic.
Now, Jimmy, can you tell us anything about the Bush unit? Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Bush unit.
What's that? I like the Bush.
I like the Bush.
What do you do there?
I'm bouncing. sandwiches and custard and biscuits and cup of tea.
And what about your friends? What are their names?
Cyrus and Oliver and Shay and Cassie and Jimmy.
Okay. Well, it's lovely that Jimmy's still able to go along, Rita, isn't it, and to this. But at the end of the day, are you confident it's going to stay open?
Well, no, I'd like to be, but I'm not, actually. I think probably next year. I think this council will keep on trying to take it away. I don't kind of know why, because the money that they say they'll save on it isn't that much. But I think it's one of those things that's going to keep on trying to happen, but we'll just keep on trying to keep it going because it's so important.
Now, do you and the other mums and dads that use Bush buy into the reasons that are being given for these cuts?
No, absolutely not. No, because what they're saying is that to save money, they were offering us foster care and stuff like that, which is just really, really not comparable and not very safe. And most of us wouldn't have done it anyway. So, and they're saying there's not enough money. But no, none of us really buy into that because we feel that there should be enough money, that a lot, most people who are paying taxes are quite happy that some of the money goes towards disabled children.
Yeah, also, I mean, we're the sixth, I think the latest count, richest country in the world. Yeah, it just seems incredible that we couldn't pay a few staff to look after disabled kids. I do you believe that? I'm not sure I do.
No, I don't really believe that, no, no. I think, anyway, as I said to one of the councillors, maybe the mayor, the mayor's got a lot of money. Maybe he should put his hand in his pocket next time and just, fork out the extra money, because I think he can afford it.
OK, Rita, well, we'll keep our eye on this one, but thanks ever so much for coming in and bringing us up to date. A bit of good news for a change.
Yay!
But we've got to keep our eye on this one.
Yes.
All right, thanks very much for joining us. And you, Jimmy, thank you.
Should we say thank you?
Thank you.
Bless you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Dr. Roland Dye. Hi, Roland, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony, nice to be here.
Reason you come in is because I discovered, and I didn't realise this, even though you've been on this show before, that you're actually a PhD in medical physics, and you're a bit of an expert in nuclear physics. So that, how on earth did you get into that, Roland?
Well, I grew up here in Bristol. I went to school, and it was that era, I think, when the government was wanting to steer lots of young kids into various professional trainings, and physics was one of them. And if you think about that era back in the 60s, nuclear bombs, nuclear power, the white heat of British technology, as Harold Wilson went on about it, they wanted, young people going to university doing things like physics, and I was steered in that direction.
Now, I've come across you because you're a campaigner on Palestine, and I know that the Israelis do have nuclear weapons. We don't often hear about it on the mainstream media. How do we know that the Israelis have nuclear weapons, and how many do they have?
Well, they neither confirm nor deny, just on many things, that they have them, but it's a well-kept secret. A very commendable scientist called Vanunu actually leaked the information. I think he worked there and he took a camera in. He photographed loads of stuff and, gave it to the media.
Yeah, it was the Sunday
Times.
And
as a result, Mossad did something very nasty to him.
So what happened to Mordecai Vanunu then?
Well, he wasn't in Israel at the time. I can't remember.
He was in London,
I think. In this country,
originally, yeah.
And they came and got him and took him away.
Well, that's not very good of our security service to allow another foreign security service to come in and pinch someone when they've come here, I suppose, to blow the whistle on their own government, breaking international law, I suppose, by developing nuclear weapons. Is that right?
I don't know if anybody's looked into it, but the word collusion does spring to mind. A bit like Britain didn't make that much fuss about Mossad using British passports when they rubbed somebody out a couple of years ago. It does make you wonder.
Yeah, so what's your view then on the whole situation in Israel-Palestine? Because, we keep often seeing, for example, the Iranians are a big danger in that part of the world, and yet the Israelis have nuclear weapons, but they're one of us. That's the message that seems to come across.
Yes, it is. And yet Israel breaks international law left, right and centre. They probably have slightly more nuclear weapons than this country, and yet they don't theoretically admit to it. We probably gave them the technology. There's more stories and investigative journalism required to dig into that. But Vanunu certainly was a hero. I mean, he spent, I can't remember how much of his sentence in solitary confinement. He's a lovely chap. If he wants to go out for a meal in Jerusalem and he goes to the Palestinian quarter and restaurants, they don't give him the bill. They really respect him. And, you see that? I've shaken hands with him. He was in a cafe where we were after an Olive Harvest trip or something, and people said, oh, that's Vanunu over there. Are you joking, really?
Okay,
went across, said hello, said well done, what can you say?
You've met the whistleblower. I seem to remember at the time, it must have been in the 1980s, I think, that he was somehow arrested or captured.
I think it was a honey trap.
In another part of the world. And as he was being whisked away, he wrote something on his hand, a flight number, and then he held it up to the window, and some photographers took a photograph of his hand, and that's how they worked out how he'd been kidnapped.
Okay.
An interesting story that, anyway.
Yeah.
When the Sunday,
an interesting aside.
Well, yeah, when the Sunday Times used to do really good exposés, which it doesn't seem to do that much these days. But anyhow, that's a whole other story. So why, you're also been campaigning campaigning around the whole idea of nuclear weapons here in Britain and against the spending of £100 billion of our money on Trident. What from your medical physics PhD brought you to that conclusion?
As an undergraduate, they give you those lectures on nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and I don't think I was very bright, and my social conscience wasn't very well developed, but I was a bit uneasy, and I moved in the direction of, you know, using radioisotopes in the health service for imaging, helping doctors save lives. So I guess I had a developing social conscience there. But let's just stop and talk about nuclear weapons. And normally in my pocket I carry a little playing card. It's an infographic of Trident. And this is, if you just give me a minute or two, this is a quick maths lesson. Britain has four submarines based in Scotland, much to the dislike of the Scottish, and well done to them as well. So one of those submarines is under the ocean on patrol at any one time.
One out of the four? That's not very good, is it? Well, only one quarter.
The rest are in for servicing and training and repairs. It does make you wonder,
doesn't
it? Come
on, Royal Navy, you can get at least two out there, surely.
Oh, well, that's where the Lib Dems are so pathetic. They say they'd cut down from four to three as regards to replacement. But anyway, at least one is on patrol at any one time. And it's loaded with eight American Trident missiles with American guidance systems. So they control it all, not the British.
Hang on.
The British make the nuclear warheads, and there's five on each missile.
Okay, so the actual intercontinental ballistic missile that would come popping out of the top of the submarine is totally controlled by the Americans.
Yep.
So, in a way, it's not really Britain's nuclear deterrent.
You're going
because
to use
the Americans have, the Americans have got a kind of veto switch, haven't they, on whether they want these to be used, even if we were in the middle of an all-out war.
You're going to repeat that phrase, the independent British nuclear deterrent. Yeah, it's a pack of lies. Yep. So it's controlled by the Americans. But we make the nuclear missiles, the bombs that go on these things.
The actual bombs that go on them. And they need to be looked after, don't they, from time to time. I'm sure you're going to mention the word Burfield.
Yeah.
So where is Burfield and what do they do there?
Well, Aldermaston makes the stuff and Burfield puts it together, basically. Think components and then car assembly. A lot of your listeners may be surprised to hear where Britain's nuclear bomb factory is. Now, if you were a sort of national planner, you'd put something dangerous, like a nuclear bomb factory, at an extremity somewhere. So if I was to say 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading, I bet somebody out there is a bit surprised to hear that. Yes, folks. 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading. It's only a nuclear bomb factory, nothing to worry about.
Okay, so that's Aldermaston.
Aldermaston makes the stuff, Burfield assembles it.
Okay, and then that
You can see it from the M4.
Okay, so then that goes off up north. Now, I remember many years ago, this is going back probably 10 years or so, I went out on a I think it was called Nuke Watch.
Did you?
Yes,
chasing the convoys.
Yes, with my video camera, and that was great fun. In the middle of the night, I was given a call, and they said, there's a nuclear convoy heading your way. And so a friend came round to pick me up, and we got in their car, and we were following this convoy down the motorway. And overtook it and took a bit of film out the window, you know. Mm. So those convoys, they go around the country.
Yep.
They're
up and down about every month.
And they take, I suppose, they're taking these nuclear warheads up to Faslane,
well,
or they to
every
go
time
into the ship.
There's about 200 stored next door to Faslane. There's a base called Coalport. So when the submarines come in or go out, they're actually loaded and unloaded at Coalport, which stores them, presumably in a large garden shed with a big hefty padlock on the outside, 200 nuclear bombs.
Well, I'm not surprised that the Ministry of Defence are annoyed with you, Roland, because surely all this stuff is supposed to be secret.
Everyone knows about it. You don't have to Google very far to find out this stuff. And these things are going up and down the motorway about once a month. Every time they make one and it goes up there, they've got to bring an old one back because of the radioactive decay. They've got to reprocess, take it all apart and reprocess it all. It's a big job, and it's all coming out of our pockets.
Okay, so
now each of those British bombs is the equivalent of eight times the explosive power of what killed about 140,000 people at Hiroshima.
Okay, so how big are they?
What's the kilogram of plutonium? You know, they're not.
How many megatons or kilotons?
I don't know that figure, but eight times the destructive power of what was used at Hiroshima, which killed 140,000 people. So my maths is one submarine times eight missiles, if they're all fired, which is they're designed to do, times five warheads, times eight times the destructive power of Hiroshima, which was 140,000, nearly 50 million people. So if Cameron presses the red button, nearly 50 million people will be dead within an hour.
Crikey. Well, that's pretty scary. But, I mean, what about the argument that actually the nuclear weapons have actually kept the peace over the last 60 years or so?
I'm glad you asked me that, because people do often, they look scared, and maybe they talk a bit vaguely about, you know, Muslims coming from North Korea or something like that, or don't we need this as a last-ditch insurance policy? And I say to them, who are the most aggressive nations on this planet? And a look of relief comes across their face, but they go, I suppose we are. Okay, remove the word defence and put the word aggression. Okay, these have a military purpose. They're used to threaten other countries.
You mean the Ministry of Aggression?
The Ministry of Aggression, that's what it should be called.
Crikey. Yep.
Because you look at what Britain's done around the world, we're responsible for millions of deaths.
Well, certainly we have been involved in the whole Iraq, Libya, Syria, yep. You know, supporting the so-called nice rebels in Syria, this kind of thing. I mean, it's a pretty appalling. And I think you're right. You know, most of the aggression seems to have come from the Western world, from the EU, from the US, from NATO over the last few years.
But so these things are a very large loaded gun in the hands of the ruling elite of this country. As I say, at the press of a button could kill 50 million people. Actually, the maths is wrong. Now, you haven't spotted it. Took me a while. There are actually 16 firing tubes on each of the submarines. As an act of goodwill, they only load half of them. Or they say they only load half of them. That could change. So it could be twice that number. It could be 100 million people. And by the way, unleashing just our country's nuclear weapons from one submarine could then precipitate a nuclear winter, and we will starve to death.
Well, those people that say that there's not going to be any kind of nuclear exchange, because no one would think about it. Well, think again, because General Thomas Power, back in the Cuban Missile Crisis, was actually actively trying to get a nuclear war started. He was the boss of Strategic Air Command, and he said, actually, now is the time to nuke Russia and nuke the Soviets, because they're catching up with our nuclear warhead count. There was what was called the missile gap. Which meant that the Russians had less missiles than the Americans. And so if the Americans had a war in 1962, they could have wiped out more Russians than the Russians could have wiped out of Americans. So he actually said we could have won a nuclear war with no more than expectable casualties. Yeah. And he was actively trying to get the war started by doing things like launching ICBMs, these ballistic missiles, towards the Soviet Union with no warheads in, just to make them scared and maybe launch one back, this kind of thing. So check out General Thomas Power and his friend Curtis LeMay at Strategic Air Command. We're really going great guns back in the 1960s to try and kick that war off. And it was only John F. Kennedy that stopped it happening, many people say. And, of course, he was then dead a year after that. He stopped that nuclear war. Most people would argue that was done by Lyndon Johnson and the CIA and the FBI, actually, the American military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us about, bumping off their own president. But anyhow, let's get back to the your nuclear expertise, because one of the things to explain about this is the way uranium works, because it's mined, it's an ore, and then it's separated. This is what the Iranians are getting into a lot of trouble about, because they're trying to have a nuclear power program, and that they're separating the two different types of uranium, the U-238 and the U-235. What is that all about? How does that work?
Well, there's two methods, I understand. There's gaseous diffusion, and then the centrifuges. So Britain's doing that all the time. The yellow cake comes in at Ellesmere Port.
Uranium ore.
Uranium ore, yeah. And then there's an enrichment plant nearby, near Chester, and that's where the enrichment is done. Then it goes into the nuclear power stations, which you have to have to then have a bomb program.
Okay, but why? I mean, it sounds very strange to me. Say, for example, something like water or an element like copper. How can you have two different types of copper? You know, you've got U-235 and U-238. What makes them different?
For any element, there might be many different isotopes. It's all to do with your protons and neutrons. So your protons determine the electric charge, which is the chemical property. So let's take hydrogen, the most simple, top of the periodic table. One proton, one electron going around it, so it's chemically hydrogen. But neutrons, because they have neutral charge, can be added to the nucleus, and it alters the weight. The chemical properties are much the same, but it changes its atomic properties. So that's why you have heavy hydrogen, heavy water, deuterium and tritium. And hence all the way down the periodic table. So for every element, there is actually a mixture of different isotopes.
Now, you mentioned the periodic table there. I mean, if you've ever been into a chemistry lab at school or at university, you will definitely see one of these on the wall somewhere.
Yep.
What is the periodic table?
Well, it's all the elements known to us on this planet arranged into quite a tidy list or table according to their chemical characteristics. So I seem to remember it goes hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, chlorine.
Crikey, you
and
seem
then
to remember.
That's the first row, and then the next row down again. But as I think there's eight categories, so they all have similar chemical properties.
And you won't find
you go
water.
Lower down.
You won't find water there, though. Why is that?
Well, that's because it's a mixture, a chemical mixture of hydrogen and oxygen.
Okay, so the periodic table is the elements, which is the basic
building blocks
of matter.
Even though those elements then can have a finer internal structure, let's call it, which are the isotopes.
Okay, so these isotopes, let's get back to uranium.
Uranium-235.
Because this is how the whole nuclear thing first started, isn't
yep.
it? You know, there was a separation of U-238 from U-235, because when you get the ore, you get a metal called uranium, but it's got these two isotopes in it, these two different types of uranium.
Yeah, and one of them is fissile. It will undergo fissile reaction.
That's U-235. So you... Once you've separated the two, whether it's a centrifuge like the Iranians are using and Britain
fraction of a percent of the stuff that they want.
You get something called, it's enriched uranium, which is the U-235, and U-238 is depleted uranium.
Yep. And
now,
that's
I've heard
they
about.
Spread around in Iraq.
Yes, well, it's I've heard about this depleted
shocking.
Uranium, this U-238, before. What do they do with it?
The American. Well,
and
they
it
give
should
it,
be a
they
nuclear
give
waste.
It away.
Nuclear
they give
waste.
It away to the munitions industry. Because it has a very useful, it has a couple of very useful properties. It's very heavy, so it's heavier than lead, which is classically used to make bullets from. And also on impact, it will burn furiously. So it will actually punch its way through armour plating or down through concrete into an underground bunker. So it's the munition of choice. But of course, it will leave this residue of combusted uranium. And the toxic legacy in countries where this has been used extensively, first of all in Yugoslavia, more recently in Iraq, and the birth deformities in Fallujah are actually worse than in Hiroshima or Nagasaki after the nuclear bombs.
Why is that then?
It's really nasty stuff.
It sort of persists in the environment.
You shouldn't be setting fire to it and letting the smoke blow around.
It persists in the environment in a way maybe that the fallout from the Japanese bombs or the American bombs dropped on Japan at the end of World War II didn't persist
in
the environment so much.
They persisted as well. And while we're talking about that, by the way, the genetic damage comes down through the generations. It never actually goes away. So there are third generation people in Japan, men and women, who wants to date one of them? Because they might have genetic damage from tainted for life. It's horrible.
It's mutations, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It never goes away. It's very important to point out that once you release this stuff from atomic bombs or from nuclear reactors when they go wrong, we're going to be talking about Fukushima in a moment, you can't really clean this mess up. It persists forever.
Now, you mentioned Fukushima there. How long is it since that
it's
it
the
disaster four year, happened?
We're just passing the four-year anniversary.
Okay. So why? I mean, surely it's all been cleaned up now, hasn't it?
I was reading some literature on this just recently. Now, when I was a kid at school or a scientist at university or whatever, they teach you the SI system, killer, you know, mega, giga. I hadn't come across terra for quantities of radioactivity. There are terabecquerels.
We get terabytes, don't we, of hard drive space
nowadays. Well, we've progressed onto that. There are terabecquerels of radioactivity. You've got the contents of three nuclear power stations, plus the fuel rods, which were stored on site because nobody else wanted them stored anywhere near them, on that site. And all of that is melted down into the ground and is slowly, inexorably edging its way towards the Pacific Ocean. I don't know what the effect would that be if it's released into the oceans. It might be we're facing extinction It really is that bad. And you can't trust these private companies. They cover this up left, right and centre.
Well, I know TEPCO that runs the power plants over there has been really basically in denial ever since this happened about the danger of it. I mean, how does it compare with other nuclear disasters like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl in Russia, in Ukraine?
Yeah, Chernobyl was bad enough. Now, again, the official figures are all massaged and fudged because they don't go out and collect the real data. But studies in the Soviet Union point to about 1 million premature deaths because of Chernobyl. Now, that was one reactor that caught fire. So at Fukushima, there was three, plus the stored fuel rods. And all that is sliding towards the ocean. It's horrific. And they're covering it up left, right and centre. And worse still, our government and the media, apart from your good selves, chooses not to talk about it because they want to build something of that scale down at Hinkley. We're 1 hour downwind of Hinkley. If that ever caught fire, we'd be breathing that muck in.
Now, the water, just to remind everyone, was a tsunami that hit the inadequate seawall around the plant. I remember reading one of the WikiLeaks, one of Julian Assange, who's now, of course, basically under house arrest in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. One of his emails showed that the International Atomic Energy Authority had written to the Japanese government and to TEPCO saying that the safety precautions at Fukushima were inadequate, and they'd ignored those warnings. That was about a year before the accident happened because there was an inadequate seawall around the plant. And ultimately, around about 1,600 people in Fukushima were killed, mostly by the tsunami itself. But a disaster area, an absolute disaster area. How on earth was this allowed to happen?
Cost-cutting, head in the sand, not wanting to hear the bad news. And it's the same here, isn't it? I mean, the private companies who have been running Sellafield have just had the contracts pulled out of their hand by the government. How badly must they have been doing it for that to happen, this privatising government that we've got at the moment? So we should be very scared. And thank you. People should be asking a lot of questions because it just isn't safe. Look, they're reckless with our safety in the same way as they're reckless with the lives of people in other countries they want to dominate. You know, 1 million people have been slaughtered in Iraq in that war alone. You know, they don't care. They don't care about them abroad. And at the end, they don't care about us.
So what's the motive for the Japanese authorities then to build a plant? Why didn't they just build some sort of gas power station?
You're asking me to discuss, you know, large-scale national economics. Did this country go in for
nuclear? Because you know, you're arguing that this kind of power production is a bad idea. So what is it?
I'm saying it's not safe.
Yeah. So why is it that governments decide to spend our money on this kind of thing rather than something simpler and cheaper?
Well, I agree. Now, they're going on an absolute limb with Hinkley because they guarantee twice the going rate for the electricity that the plant will produce, plus the fact that we as taxpayers will have to pay for the decommissioning. If ever it goes wrong, it's uninsurable, so we will have to pay for the cleanup, and we're going to have to store the waste as well for hundreds or millions of years afterwards. What sort of deal is that? It's terrible, and it shouldn't be going ahead.
What about the possibility of this radiation from Fukushima leaking into the sea? Because, of course, there are people saying over there in Japan that actually they should release this Fukushima contaminated water into the sea.
Well, I think they're releasing it all the time without telling anybody. Same as Sellafield in this country. There aren't external controls to be keeping an eye on these things. And it's an absolute horror story. And by the way, we're soon going to move our topic onto fracking, which I hadn't really taken a lot of notice to about a year ago. And I was alarmed to discover a long list of radiation aspects involved with fracking, which
really?
Is on our doorstep.
Well, I mean, it does look as if fracking may be being reined back simply because of the falling price of oil. But anyway, I didn't know there was any kind of connection between radiation and fracking. I knew about the earthquakes. I knew about poisoning our water supply,
yep.
But not this. So what's happening with radiation and fracking?
How long have we got? I've got a list of 7 items here. And this is what I've been involved in just recently. First of all, there's well logging. You put something the size, or they put something the size of a small radiotherapy source down the well to do a sort of analysis of the rock strata. This sounds scary. Sometimes they lose them. They lose them at quite a rate of knots. Historically, they've been lost down the wells, or sometimes they do literally fall off the back of a lorry. These are very dangerous things. So that is a routine thing that's used by well logging. Secondly, as you know, when they drill down and then drill horizontally, they have to fracture the rock. Okay. Currently, they use conventional explosives. They have these sort of machine gun multi-nozzle devices that go down the hole. Conventional explosives aren't as powerful as what we mentioned just now, depleted uranium. Halliburton have a patent for a depleted uranium penetrator to be used in fracking. And what sort of residue is that going to leave? And that gets into the drinking water. You can work it out. Then, the deeper you go into the ground, the more radioactive are the rocks. And shale, for gas production, is particularly radioactive. This is called NORM, normally occurring radioactive materials. So the deeper you go, the more radioactive. So we've all put raw plugs in a wall at home. You know, the dust that comes out? There's an awful lot of that when you're drilling down a few kilometres into the ground. So those drill cuttings have to be disposed of. What? In the local garbage tip? And all the spills at the wellhead are going to contaminate that ground. The farmer's never going to have that land back to grow crops, or we hope not. Then there's the gas. The gas that comes out, because it's coming out of the rock, which is like a sponge, there's a much larger surface area. There'll be more radon gas, much higher levels of radon gas in the gas that's being brought out. It needs to be stored for a long time for that radon gas to decay. If it's pumped through to your homes, you're going to be burning that in your kitchen. Radon is the second largest reason for lung cancer in this country. Shall I go on? The water, which is used in fracking, well, it's also going to flush out quite a range of radioactive materials. The real nasties are strontium, polonium. Remember that murder case using polonium?
Well, two murder cases. One was Alexander Litvinenko, and the other one was Yasser Arafat.
Yes, yeah. But the biggest and worst baddie is radium. We've all heard of radium. It killed Madame Curie, most famous woman scientist. When that's released into the environment, it mimics calcium. It will bioaccumulate up through the food chain and eventually come back to us. It causes bone cancer. When I worked in the health service, we were doing imaging techniques and different organs of the body put in different tracers. If someone has something wrong with their skeleton, you put in a little tracer, which disappears very rapidly, but you have enough time to take a picture. You get a little cute little picture of someone's skeleton. They look really cute until you see the one that's got the glowing hot spots on. Okay, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that's something wrong. Very often the diagnosis was that's bone cancer. It's a horrible way to go. Now, the reason I went up to Blackpool was once I stumbled upon this. If they're releasing that stuff into the environment, the levels of bone cancer or whatever are going to rise. Nobody's going to pin that on the fracking companies, but that's what's going to happen. And finally, by the way, if you're going around the country drilling lots of holes, you're doing a geological survey. So you might find the ideal spot for a deep underground depository for radioactive waste. Or alternatively, you've got all these holes. There's a proposal going through the House of Lords at the moment to use those holes to dispose of radioactive waste. So that's my seven horror stories of the connections between radiation and fracking.
But you did mention there that it's been used in medicine. Tell us what you were doing with it in medicine, because it is actually, let's not say that this technology isn't useful for some things. It certainly is, and I mean, I'm quite sure you would agree. That radioactive materials can and should be used in medicine. So how did you use them?
Yeah, they're used in biochemistry tests and what we were doing, and in radiotherapy, and what we were doing was diagnostic imaging. So these are very short-lived tracers, which are made specially with a short lifetime, so they're put into the patient in order to show metabolic
function.
Okay,
when you say short lifetime, how long does this radiation last?
Well, the stuff we were using had a half-life of 6 hours. So a few days later, it's virtually gone. So that's about as short as you can get. Ideal material.
So what kind of complaints was this useful for then?
Just on average, the same as a couple of X-ray pictures. Now, it would be nice if nobody needed X-ray pictures and nobody needed isotope scans. But, you know, it's one there are various diagnostic choices.
Give us an idea of a couple of complaints that this might be useful in helping diagnose.
I was mentioning bone cancer. Right, if there's a cancer growing in someone's bones, it's metabolizing faster, so it will actually take up more of the traces. So it shows up as a hot spot on the scan, whereas it might not show up on the X-ray picture or the MRI.
And how does that radioactive stuff you're looking at on the X-ray get into the patient then?
Oh, it's injected into the bloodstream, and you just wait a few hours for it to get metabolised. It's in the bones, you get your picture, and yeah, by next day it's virtually all disappeared.
Sounds a bit horrific, having something radioactive injected into your blood.
So is having an X-ray picture where you have X-rays being shined through you. So, you know, it's a choice of small risk for a large diagnostic outcome. So I say it'd be nice if nobody needed any of the things, but, you know, we fall over, we break our arm, go to the hospital, they'll take your X-ray picture. It's a finite risk, but it's very low, and the diagnostic benefits and to you as a person are overwhelming. It should stop there. We don't need nuclear power, and we definitely don't need nuclear weapons, and that's where it should stop, in my opinion.
So are you going to tell the Iranians that they shouldn't have nuclear power?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. But I wouldn't join the right-wing propagandists who are just criticising Iran, because they're just following the same progression as what this country and other Western powers and countries like Israel have done, because that's just being used as a stick to beat them.
Okay.
A non-proliferation treaty should apply to everybody, including this country, because this country is going to break the non-proliferation treaty by upgrading Trident. So they're all sinners, and they should all be stopped.
Okay. Where would you point us to have a look at, or online or elsewhere, to find out more about the nuclear deterrent, the nuclear weapons, the Trident upgrade, and that kind of thing?
Well, actually, CND, we all know CND, are doing an absolutely marvellous job. And they're saying, why spend $100 billion on weapons of mass destruction when we need to be spending it on the health service, on social services, on renewable energy, on building more houses, creating jobs for young people? It's a no-brainer. £100 billion is more than the austerity cuts that we're staggering under at the moment. So that is obscene and it's crazy.
Well, it's not necessarily crazy. The military people will say, well, if we don't have a nuclear deterrent, the Russians will be sailing straight up the Thames.
If we weren't going around causing such aggression around the rest of the world, I don't think we'd be under risk.
Okay, well, Roland Dye, Dr. Roland Dye indeed, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Angela Balassi, and I'll be speaking to Tony Gosling about the Hillsborough inquest. The senior police officer in charge on the day of the Hillsborough disaster has told the inquest that he probably wasn't the best man for the job. Former Chief Superintendent David Duckenfield was in charge when 96 Liverpool fans were fatally crushed at Sheffield Wednesday Stadium. He's accepted that his experience of planning and policing was very limited, and in hindsight, it had been a serious mistake to take on the role of match commander. So, Tony, do you think he should be given credit for his honesty?
Well, certainly, yes, it's about time, isn't it? A little bit late. So we're talking about 25 years or so after the event. It's a little bit late, isn't it? I don't think you can call it justice for the truth to be coming out now, all this time afterwards. Incidentally, I'm in contact with a former senior person in the civilian side of South Yorkshire Police who were very much involved in all of this. And in the police canteen in South Yorkshire, not sure which city, probably in Sheffield, he's told me in the past, and you can probably look this up online, this old interview I did a few years ago, that Duckenfield was actually a gibbering wreck under the table when the disaster happened. So whilst there could have been a lot of things happening, for example, to make special arrangements for ambulances to be able to get in and out of the stadium, for arrangements to be made to relieve the pressure on the squeezed crowds, that kind of thing, Duckenfield apparently was under the table a gibbering wreck and completely incapable of giving any kind of orders and commands to the police on the scene to alleviate the problem as it was developing. So that's one of the reasons many people believe why so many died. It was because basically there was no one in charge.
You say he's a gibbering wreck under the table. Was this actually during the crisis
during
itself?
The incident, once he realised that there was a crisis was unfolding before him, rather than deal with the crisis and act He basically started gibbering and decided in his own mind that he couldn't deal with the situation.
Mm.
And rather than pass on the command of the situation to somebody else, he just kind of gave up.
Surely somebody else could have taken responsibility.
Well, it is possible someone else did and could have, but this testimony I just found quite interesting. The guy's name's Tony Farrell, and I've checked out his credentials, and he certainly was working for South Yorkshire Police at the time. And the other thing that Tony said was that, and which has later been borne out by testimony at this Hillsborough inquest, the second inquest, of course, by the way, into this. The first inquest really was a cover-up more than an inquest. And the other thing that's come out is that Duckenfield was a Freemason. And that is also many of the police at the time believed that there was a Masonic conspiracy going on. There's a headline in the Liverpool Echo, 17th of November last year, by Eleanor Barlow. Hillsborough commander David Duckenfield was in the same Freemason's lodge as the officer he replaced. So the match
is that
commander,
Chief Superintendent Brian Mole?
Yes, that's right. So as he replaced Mole, he was also in the same Masonic lodge. So interesting, isn't it, that it could possibly be here. And in fact, it looks quite likely, as we know that there's quite a lot of attempts by Freemasons to recruit police into lodges. It may even be an all-police lodge. These things do exist, where every single Mason in a particular lodge is a policeman, that the decisions about promotion and this kind of thing and succession are made within a Freemason's lodge rather than actually by, for example, the police authority, etc. So it may well have been that he was put into that position because he was a Freemason, because he was in the same lodge, rather than because on his merits. And that, of course, would bear out what you were saying originally, that he's saying that he wasn't the best man for the job.
But he has criticised Brian Mole. He said he did not offer to help him in his new role, and said, in fact, that he almost seemed jealous and was guarding his position. So would that not contradict this?
Well, possibly. But, I mean, the main point here is that these sorts of decisions about who is going to take on these incredibly important jobs of public trust should not be made amongst Freemasons within secret societies and in secret meetings. They should be made openly, and people should be promoted on their merits. And I mean, that's just to elaborate a little bit on what was said last December. I mean, there's a very good article I noticed in The Guardian on the 17th of December 2014. Masons colluded, the Hillsborough court was told. A police constable told the inquest, representing 75 victims' families, that he did not come forward about Masonic meeting earlier because of fears over his job. Interesting that such a fear could be there, that someone may have to actually end their career if they mention Freemasonry. And in fact, you know, there's no reason why this particular officer, Maxwell Groom, who was a constable at the time, shouldn't now feel also that his job might be threatened because he's now mentioned this at the inquest. I'll just read you a little bit of the story. Senior South Yorkshire police officers who were Freemasons orchestrated a Masonic conspiracy to shift the blame after the Hillsborough disaster in 1989. The inquests into the deaths of the 96 victims have been told. Maxwell Groom, a constable at the time, said that after the disaster at the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest at Sheffield Wednesday's football ground, the word inside the force was that Freemason officers held a meeting to blame Superintendent Roger Marshall. Groom said he heard the meeting took place in porter cabins at South Yorkshire's police's area office and was attended by Chief Superintendent David Duckenfield, who had commanded the match. Questioned by Michael Mansfield QC, representing 75 families whose relatives were killed at Hillsborough, Groom said he believed Duckenfield was a Grand Master of a particularly influential lodge, the Door Lodge, in Sheffield. Now, I've done a bit of digging into this, Angela, and it's interesting because the Door Lodge is not part of the Yorkshire Freemason province, it's part of the Derbyshire Freemason province. So Door is on the outskirts of Sheffield. So this is why you have to actually get the books and realise that you've got this whole entire world of Freemasonry, although you might have a place which is in the official British county of South Yorkshire. It's not in the Masonic county of South Yorkshire, Door. It's in the Masonic province of Derbyshire. So if you're looking into these sorts of things, you've got to be aware that there's this kind of parallel structure of the country divided up into areas which don't necessarily correlate to the official counties.
OK, initially, though, the fans themselves were blamed, weren't they?
That's right, through the Sun newspaper particularly, and that, it seems, was the main conduit for information from this alleged Masonic conspiracy that took place in these porter cabins. So they sat down, they said, right, we're going to blame this person, blame that person, and it seems that there were certain routes into the press that they believed wouldn't challenge what they were saying. And of course, this is a major, major problem in journalism, where you've got people just simply reporting what they're being told without questioning it. That's not journalism.
Well, the editor at the time, Calvin McKenzie, said the information came from an MP and also from the police, and that he trusted those sources. In hindsight, we can see that was an error. Is that not typical, though, to trust your sources when they seem to be reputable?
Well, of course, but then, of course, what also happens is, if you've got a conspiracy, I mean, that involves more than one person, doesn't it? Possibly a police officer, possibly an MP.
Why do you think it's taken so long to come to the forefront?
Well, it's the British establishment, isn't it? I think we've got a kind of almost a permanent government called the establishment, the people that own and run things in Britain. Here in Bristol, you could just point to the merchant venturers quite simply and say, well, these people are the super rich, many of them are multi-generational rich, that do things like own our building societies and run our building societies, own and run our public utilities, things like places like Bristol Water. And many of our institutions are populated by these people, and they just have a sense of privilege. And what the important thing to see here is that they're handing it down through their families and through their friends, and there's no real competition for these senior jobs.
There seems to have been a lot of finger pointing. Is that helpful?
Well, depends on who at, doesn't it? If you're pointing the finger at someone who's actually really done it, what it seems has happened here, as we were saying earlier, is that the finger has been pointed deliberately at the wrong person. And that, unfortunately, is what happens with things like the 9/11 attacks, the 7/7 attacks in London. The person who the finger is initially pointed at in the same day and the same few days after those attacks is often what sticks. And I think with all of these cases, particularly with these terrorist attacks too, information then comes to light, which gives a much more complex job, and probably the finger has been pointing the wrong way.
And have lessons been learned?
No, I don't think they necessarily have. I think it's just because the survivors and victims' families in Liverpool have been so dogged in pursuing the truth, and they're not prepared to put up with lies and cover-up.
And finally, Margaret Aspinall of the Hillsborough Family Support Group said she hopes this is the beginning of the end. Do you think this is the case?
I think it is, because we're getting some of the real, we say, deep state politics coming out in this. And I would just like much more of this kind of thing to be happening with other inquiries. Particularly, I'm thinking of the Westminster Whitehall child sex abuse inquiry, which of course includes things like the royal family as well as possibly involved in this. So we do need to ask those very difficult questions, and then perhaps we'll get to the truth. So maybe what's happening in Hillsborough could be an example for the future, how to run a real inquiry.
Thank you.
Thanks, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff Sparks is here with the What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. This is the What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 20th of March, the Casuals will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bathford, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 20th of March, City of Lights will be performing with support from Danny Lando and also Tell the Hoy at the Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Enter Song of the Week, and I present The Doors. This group formed in 1965 and split up in 1973, 2 years after Jim Morrison's death. In their career, they have released 9 studio albums, 3 of which was after Jim Morrison's death, 5 live albums and numerous singles. Also, after they had split up, numerous compilation albums have been released. This is from the album Essential Rarities and is the demo version of Whiskey, Mystics and Men.
Well, I'll tell you a story of whiskey and mystics and men, da-da-da, and about the believers and how the whole thing began, da-da-da. First there were women and children obeying the moon, da-da-da. labour and sickness too soon. Da da da. You can try to remind me instead of the other you can. Da da da. You can help to ensure that we all insecure our command. Da da da. If you don't give a listen, I won't try to tell your new hand. Da da da. This is it, can't you see that we all have our ends in the van? Da da da. Teachers and preachers of wealth were arraigned, we could see quite a future for me in the literal sense. And if all of the people could claim to inspect such regret, da-da-da, well, we'd have no forgiveness, forgetfulness, send away. Da-da-da. We must try to find a new answer instead of a way.
That was The Doors with Whiskey, Mystics and Men from the album Essential Rarities. Into Saturday, 21st of March, The Selector will be performing with support from the Tuts at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £16.50 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Finally, on 21st of March, the Lewis Creven Band will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9:30pm. That was all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
You sound like you've got a bit of a cold to me, Jeff.
Does sound a bit fruity, yes.
Also, on The Doors, do you know why Jim Morrison was killed? Actually, apparently he died...
Well, I've heard various... He was found in a bathtub in his apartment, but in the past, year or so, I've heard that he actually died outside a nightclub and they took the body back to the apartment and placed him in the bathtub. That's the other...
I think you've got it.
But that's the other version I've heard recently.
There is a motive for murder as well with him, or assassination, and that is that his father, Admiral Morrison, was an admiral in the US Navy in the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, and he ordered an attack on the Israelis during the 1967 war because the Israeli motor torpedo boats and Air Force attacked an American ship. So he was the admiral of the 6th Fleet and he ordered a retaliatory strike. Jim Morrison's dad did. So there you got a bit of a motive for an assassination, basically killing Jim Morrison to get at his father, who was leading a kind of move against the Israelis within the US military.
Right.
Interesting theory, but you're right about the nightclub because, for example, his father was told by the defense attaché at the Paris embassy, the US embassy in Paris, that Jim had died in hospital and he never was even taken to hospital. No, so there you go, someone was lying somewhere. Anyway, thanks very much for the What's On, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Rita Lynch and Jimmy, also nuclear physicist Dr. Roland Dye and Angela Balassi, also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
That only force
riot
will make him leave.
Right.
I am certain our cause is just, a gallon of gas. And I am certain our cause is moral,
loss of life.
And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity.
Again.
Demonstrations of this kind are demoralizing the whole country.
Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
It's up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Please do your part.
What the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
Kids we've sent out into the world.